All right, if you would open your Bibles to 2 Samuel, chapter 17, excuse me. If you need a Bible, the ushers are walking around. They'll put one in your hand. I've entitled our message this morning, Best Laid Plans, and you'll see why. We're going to look at the indignant strategy, the ingenuous scheme, intel shared, informant squealed, and immense selfishness. So to get you up to speed so that we know where we're at, first of all, King David is on the run, and that in itself is a contradiction. You don't normally see kings on the run. So King David's on the run. Ahithophel wants revenge because he was Bathsheba's grandfather. And he was also one of David's good friends and counselor. So he wants revenge. David's on the run. And Absalom wants the kingdom. David's son wants the kingdom for himself. Now, if you remember, Absalom is full of pride, very prideful. He's incredibly good looking. In fact, the Bible says he was perfect from head to toe. In fact, he was so perfect from head to toe, his hair would grow so quick and so long that he cut it, and he was so prideful, he'd actually weigh his hair. Come on. Okay, I don't even think Fabio used to do that, but this guy was prideful, man. And James tells us something very important, and we're going to see that played out here. James chapter 4, verse 6 says, God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And so it is so true. And here, God is going to resist the proud. And the humbled right now is David. Although he's been in sin, and we're all sinners, but when we come before God with a repentant and a broken heart, our God is faithful to forgive us. And that's awesome. That is so important. So God resists the proud, and he gives grace to the humble. But often we have to learn our lessons the hard way. We have to learn the hard way. We push the envelope of our will, what I want, and we push it and push it till it gets to the point where God says, no, that's enough. See, there's a point that God has. He has a tipping point where God says, you know what, Randy? You've been dwelling in pride so long, I need to humble you for your own good. So don't be fooled. There is a tipping point. You may run along for a while and in pride and in rebellion, but there's a point where God says enough is enough, and I need to discipline my child. You know what the sad part is? The sad part is the proud usually don't realize that they are prideful. You may even be here and be a prideful person and not even know it. In fact, oftentimes when you go and you try to counsel the proud, oftentimes they're the ones that get mad and angry and leave because of their pride. Let me just say this. Search your heart today. As we look at pride today, as we look at bitterness and unforgiveness, you and I need to search our heart clearly and make sure that we are not the prideful. Because you might be saying that, well, I'm not prideful. You're it. As soon as you think that you're not prideful, that's pride. We all battle with pride. We all struggle with pride. So don't be self-deceived. Proverbs 29:23 says this: pride brings a person low, but the lowly in spirit gain honor. See, that is why God will humble the proud. It's not because he's like, oh yeah, watch this. It's not like he's being mean. His hope is that he'll humble you out and you'll cry out to him. Pride brings a person low, but the lowly in spirit gain honor. So when God brings a man to the end of himself where pride is dealt with, what happens is in that, he now has an opportunity to come back up because God goes, okay, now that you're humbled, I will draw near to you. But until we're humbled, as long as we're walking around in pride, God is far from us. So this morning, I want to encourage you to search your heart, to really examine yourself and see if you have pride. Best laid plans often begin with pride. So we come to the indignant strategy, verse 1 through 4. Moreover, now, by the way, remember in the last chapter what Ahithophel, the guy, when he gave counsel, it says that it was as if the oracles of God were flowing through him. He told Absalom, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to set up a tent on your daddy's house, and one by one, you're going to sleep with your stepmoms, 10 of them. And all of Israel will see you sleeping. And what a horrible scene. And I don't want to revisit it again, but now comes more counsel from Ahithophel. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men. Huge difference. And I will raise up and pursue David tonight. And I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid. Now, by the way, remember David has his 600 faithful men, plus he has some Gittites in the mix. So he may have upwards to about 1,000 men. So basically, Ahithophel says, listen, you know what? I want 12-1 odds. 12 men against every one of David's mighty men. Not a bad strategy. And he says, I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid. And all the people who are with him will flee. And I will strike only the king. Then I will bring back all the people to you when all return except the man whom you seek. In other words, the man whom you seek, being David, all the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. This saying, this idea, this concept pleased Absalom. Do you see what the concept is? Okay, Absalom, here's what we're going to do. We're going to kill your daddy. Oh, you're going to kill my daddy? That's wonderful news. How sick is that? Man, that makes me so happy. I think I want to wave my hair. That's sick. He's happy. It pleased him, the thought of killing his dad. But I want you to notice there's a few things that happen here. First of all, did you notice that Ahithophel, the one who speaks as if the oracles of God are coming from him, referred to David, it's slip of the tongue, referred to David as king. See, even in his heart, he cannot deny the fact that David is the rightful king. And I'm sure that struck a chord with Absalom, because as far as he's concerned, he's king. He's just out to kill a man to verify his kingship. Hey, I just slept with all his wives, all my stepmoms, so I'm king. But here, Ahithophel calls him king. But then right after that, I think he realized what he said. And he says, the very next verse 3, he says, I will bring back all the people to you when all return except the man whom you seek. Now, all of a sudden, it's not your dad, it's not David, and it's not the king, it's the man. He realized that he called him king, and he's like, ooh. He probably even saw Mr. Wonderful, long flowing hair guy go, well, you called him king, I'm king. Probably even saw it on his face. Because notice, right away, he's not the king, he's not David, he's the man whom you seek. But the real problem here with Ahithophel, besides the fact that he wants revenge, besides the fact that he wants to kill Absalom's daddy, if you read this statement, look at how many times I, me show up. Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David, and I will come upon him, and I will strike only the king, and I will bring back. See, bad news. First of all, when you go to talk to someone about anything, and all you hear is I, me, that person has an eye problem, and no optometrist is going to fix that. That's a matter of the heart. Now, don't get me wrong. It's impossible to form a statement without I in there. Like, you know, hey, yes, I want to go with you. Oh, you're being prideful. You said I. I feel sick. Oh, it's all about you, isn't it? No. No, that's not the problem. But when all a person can do is talk about themselves, that's a problem. When all they talk about are their accomplishments, that's a problem. I love when I hear people say that the Lord allowed me to do something, or the Lord was working through me, or if it be the Lord's will, or we shall. That's the right kind of heart. When a person is a self-made man or woman, not good. I want to be a God-made man. But prideful people are full of I's and me's in their conversation. But you know what? Also, bitter people are full of I and me. Why? Because listen, that's why they're bitter. They're bitter. It feels weird not having a mic in my hand. I'm like freaking out up here. Anyways, I'm sorry. See, the reason why we get bitter is because, oh, did you hear what they said to me? Do you see how they treated me? I have rights. I deserve it. I should be treated better than that. Do they know who I am? And it's like, wow. I don't think the person who says that knows who they are. They are full of pride, and God is far from that kind of heart. Prideful people are full of I, but bitter people are bitter because of pride. Now, the other issue that Ahithophel has in his I problem statement here, his plan, is that he excluded Absalom, who wants to be king, who wants to be in charge. Listen, if you have two prideful people, one thing the one prideful person needs not do, or else he's going to ruin the relationship, is exclude the other prideful person. And here's the thing, Absalom wants to be involved in this. He wants to take out his dad. He wants to be seen as great before all the people. And Ahithophel, in his plans, is I will go, I will do, I will kill, I will bring back. And Absalom says, well, it's a great plan, but I think you'll see after time he wasn't really satisfied with it because none of that catered to his own selfish pride. So you got two guys talking, having a conversation around a bunch of people, and they're both so full of themselves that it's disgusting. The third thing I see here, Ahithophel is making it very, very clear that he hates David. He's made it very clear. He hates David, and he wants revenge. Here's the fourth thing. Revenge is rooted in that unforgiving bitterness. When we seek to ruin others or desire for others to be ruined or don't care about others, ultimately, we ruin ourselves in the end. And you're going to see that on both these guys' parts. Because they are so selfish, they're both going to come to ruins. Let me read you a story that I found. It's not a fictional story. It's a true story. Very sad. Carl Erickson, sentenced to life in prison for murdering Norman Johnson over a 1950s high school prank. In Madison, South Dakota, 73-year-old Carl Erickson rang his old high school classmate's doorbell, verified that his identity was the right, that he had the right man, and then he shot him dead in his doorway. The question, what prompted him to kill a man, to kill his classmate? He hadn't even spoken to the guy in 50 years. Well, or almost 50 years. The startling answer, in the 1950s, in high school, in the locker room. He was humiliated. And that humiliation festered in Erickson's mind for over a half a century. And he said, "A jock strap was put on my head. I was humiliated." Psychiatrists said Erickson suffered from anxiety and depression for years. No. He suffered from unforgiveness and bitterness and pride. Erickson pleaded guilty but mentally ill to second-degree murder of Norman Johnson. Erickson told the judge, "I guess it was for something that happened over 50 years ago. It was apparently in my subconscious." No, bro. It wasn't in your subconscious. You didn't go, "Whose door am I at? Who are you? Oh, I guess I need to kill." No. This is something that he thought about, and it ate at him. It was not in his subconscious. It was on the forefront of his heart, and it ate at him, and it ate at him, and it ate at him. He was sentenced to life in prison, or should I say the rest of his life. Carl Erickson said that he would like to tell Johnson's wife that he was very sorry for what he had done, and "I wish I could turn the calendar back." Listen, all his life, he was a prisoner to his bitterness, and it robbed him. That bitterness robbed him of joy in his life for 50 years. And now, having acted upon that bitterness, he now has robbed himself of the rest of his life. You forfeit your freedom when you forfeit forgiveness. It's a fact. But here's the problem. Here's the problem that you and I have. You know what our problem is? It's natural. It's natural. It's a natural response to our anger to hold a grudge. It's a natural response. But here's the thing. The supernatural response of a regenerated Christian heart is to recognize that Christ went to the cross for my sins and their sins, even the sins that that other person commits against me. It's a supernatural response to faith when you have enough faith to forgive because it pleases him. It doesn't matter if it pleases you. You do it to please him. That's a supernatural response. That is proof that you have God's Spirit. That is proof that you are filled with God's Spirit. When you cannot forgive, that is proof that you are walking in the flesh and that you are full of pride and God is far from you. The true proof of our salvation is to recognize that Christ on the cross was not only enough for you, but it was enough for every person who's ever sinned against you. Listen, if you've been forgiven a lot, you need to forgive even much more. Jesus said this. He says, we were once enemies of God. And my whole life has been forgiven. And if I've been forgiven for my whole life, then I should be able to forgive someone's offense to me. Especially sometimes our own family members are sometimes the ones that are hardest to forgive. And we go, "I'm not going to forgive." And God says, "Well, I ain't drawn near to you. I hate the proud. I love the humble and the grace and the mercy that you show." Listen to what Jesus said. Luke chapter 12, verse 48. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. To whom much has been committed, to him they will ask the more. Here's the question, Christian. Have you not been forgiven an insurmountable debt? Then how can you not forgive an offense against you? I'll tell you how. Full of pride, full of bitterness, and not full of God's Spirit. So important. "But Randy, you don't know what they've done to me." I know, but I know what he did for you. And he did the same for them. And he set an example. And Paul said, "Follow me as I follow Christ." And you know what? Paul was forgiving. Stephen was forgiving. The disciples all martyred. They were all forgiving. But we have our pride and who we are. And we have an I problem and a me problem. My rights. I can't be treated that way. God says, fine, you go with your I. When you're done with that, when you humble yourself, when you learn to forgive, then we'll be close. Christian, don't fool yourself. Don't think you have this incredible walk with God if you can't bring yourself to forgive neighbor, friends, family members, coworkers. If you can't do that, don't fool yourself. Your walk with God is greatly, greatly diminished. But best laid plans. Now we come to the ingenuous strategy in verse 5 through 14. Now, everyone was pleased with Ahithophel's plan. Everyone loved it. It was great. Then Absalom said, now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he says too. Now, why? Why? I hope you're asking that question. Why would he do that? Hushai isn't even a Jew. Ahithophel is. Ahithophel was known to be like the oracles of God. Hushai is just, he's not even a Jew. He's an Archite. But there may be several reasons, and I'm going to throw some reasons out, and I'm going to shoot some of these reasons down so we can narrow it down and figure out why, oh, why would Absalom do this? Ask for a second opinion. One, maybe he is guilty, feeling guilty. Wait. Kill dad? Ahithophel said kill dad? That's not a good plan. Maybe he feels a little guilt. No, I don't think so. Why? Because Hushai is going to give basically the same plan, the end result where your dad will be dead, and he likes that. It's not that. So I threw that out. I go, okay, maybe he's feeling guilt. No, that doesn't work. Well, maybe he said, well, you know what? Hushai and David were close. Remember, Hushai is a guy that is such a good friend. He's the one who would whisper things in private to him. So he's thinking, you know, who else would know David better than his closest companion? Well, no, because Ahithophel was his friend and counselor for many years. The relationship became severed after he did what he did with his granddaughter. So that doesn't work either. Well, let's go to number three, the third thing. Well, remember I mentioned to you how Ahithophel's plan did not stroke his ego because it was all about Ahithophel getting revenge, and Absalom wants to take his daddy down as well. That's possible. But I think the real reason is because it didn't fit God's plan. God had another plan. God had another purpose for this whole situation. See, oftentimes, you and I can lay our plans down, what we think makes sense to us, what we think works, and God says, nah, that's not what I want. That's not what's going to happen. And we can spin our wheels in the mud all day long, but God's will, God's plan will come to fruition. And you're going to see that's why this takes place, because it was God's will. Verse 6. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says? If not, speak up. So in other words, hey, here, basically, we're not going to hear, but he tells him what Ahithophel's plan was. Here's what his plan was. Now, Ahithophel's plan was solid. I'm going to tell you right now. Yes, David's weary. Yes, he's tired. Yes, he feels defeated. Yes, 12 men per one would have been a great strategy and strike him now while the iron's hot. Great plan. It would have worked. It would have worked. But God will always, always, always even undermine good plans. Hey, take a note. You and I, we can plan something that makes sense. It sounds perfect. Sounds like it will work. Everything should go smoothly. And God says, yeah, normally it would. But not if it doesn't fit my will. Not if it doesn't fit my will. Now, the other side of that is someone can come against me or you with a great plan on how they can undo us, and it might seem like perfect on paper, but then God says, no, I'm going to protect my child. And that should bring you and I comfort. It doesn't matter what people threaten us with. It doesn't matter what's going on in politics or the government or anything like that. Listen, God's will unfold as this that's going on right here. We're talking kings. This is David, king. Absalom, who wants to be king. Ahithophel would be like the Henry Kissinger of his day. Powerful, smart guy. A mover and a shaker. This isn't like, you know, two guys standing by the convenience store fighting over a slushie. This isn't that situation. This is heavy-duty stuff. And what that tells me is God can control the hearts and minds of kings. Listen, if he can do that, he can take care of us. Isn't that comforting? So it doesn't matter if someone plans or schemes against me, and it's a great plan, great scheme. If God's not in it, ain't nothing to worry about. Ain't nothing to worry about. But look what he says. He says, shall we do what he says? What do you think of, Hushai, what do you think of Ahithophel's plan? I don't like it because there's not enough me in it. There's too much of him. But what do you think? And look at Hushai says to Absalom, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Of course, this is the Spirit of God moving through him because God has a purpose. And this is why David sent Hushai for this very purpose. But he doesn't say, Ahithophel, what an idiot. He doesn't have a clue. Don't listen. No, no, no. He says, Ahithophel, you know, he's Oracle of God guy, that dude. His advice is not good at this time. See, if it was another time, oh, man, beautiful plan. Looks perfect. Awesome. But at this time, it's not good. And let me tell you why. For, said Hushai, you know your father. Oh, playing on his way. Hey, you're smart. Remember your dad? You know your dad. No one knows your dad better than you. You don't have to come to Ahithophel or myself. You know your dad and his men, that they are mighty, that they are enraged in their minds. Oh, that's a spooky thought. The Israel's mightiest men, they're not just mad. They're enraged in their minds. They're deranged. They're drooling. They're ready for a fight. Like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And listen, in those days, they knew what a wild, angry bear would be like. They had regular encounters with them. Unlike us, we don't really grasp that. Just take like a pit bull and make him like 20 or 30 times larger and stronger, and then really make him mad. Okay, now you got the idea. Okay, so he's just like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Your father, don't forget, is a man of war, and he's got all his men of war, and they're enraged in their mind. And he's smart. He's a man of war. A man of war is always thinking about the battle. He's not going to encamp with the people. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place. And it will be when some of them are overthrown at first. And whoever hears will say, there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. In other words, listen, Absalom's men are coming and they're attacking the people. And David will be hidden in a pit somewhere else. So you're thinking you're fighting David's mighty men, and you're fighting the wrong guys. He's going to put a decoy. And even he who is valiant, whose heart is the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Listen, dude, you know your daddy. He's one of the baddest dudes around, and his men, they are vicious. And right now, dude, you slept with his wives. You ran him out of the kingdom. They are seething mad. And you want to go and mess with a hornet's nest of bad dudes? Dude, not. Listen, not at this time, man. Not with no measly 12,000 men. You've seen your dad take down 10,000 men with 300, with 600. Listen, you know your daddy better. And listen, all Israel, they're all going to blame you when they start running from David. Not good politics, bro. You need the popular vote. Therefore, here comes the advice. So what a vivid picture he painted, huh? Much better than Ahithophel. Ahithophel was, I will. And not much of a picture. Here he's got him seething mad. I mean, right now his mind's racing. It's like, yeah, dude, I want to mess with my daddy. I want to mess with him. Verse 11. Therefore, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you, Mr. Wonderful. Let's get everybody to you. See, he's not saying, let me go. Hey, I'll go get David for you. No. He, brilliant. Let them all gather to you. From Dan to Beersheba. Like the sands that are by the sea for a multitude. That you go to battle in person. Listen, you need to go get your dad. And he's like, that's right. That's what I've been waiting to hear. Gather the people to me. We'll go with all the people. Playing to his pride, man. Brilliant. Verse 12. So we will come upon him in some place where we have, where he may be found. And we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he withdraws into the city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to the city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there. Wow. But see the brilliance of this. Number one, he's playing to his pride. He paints a vivid picture, kind of like when you were a kid. I don't know. Mainly guys can understand this. I don't think girls do this as much. But guys, when you're going to get in a fight, you know, I remember, you know, I didn't want to get in a fight. I didn't really want to fight, you know. And then when friends come over, man, dude, you could just go up to him, give him one a spinning back fist or roundhouse kick, take him down, man. Everybody will see you. All of a sudden, I'm like, yeah, dude, that sounds like I could get into that. All of a sudden, you're getting pumped up. That's what he's doing. He's like, dude, you could go in. And also, you know what he's saying? Let's get all of Israel. We're talking shock and awe, not 12,000. Let's get all of Israel. Gather them. He's also buying David time. To pull together a military action like that, for them to come from Dan and Beersheba, from all these places to gather together and then go, he's buying David time. Get out of town, dude. But unfortunately, I mean, think about it. He could have been opening up a big old can of disaster for David. But that's an interesting thought. Hey, listen, if we're going to commit to this, we need to commit to shock and awe. That's even a military strategy of America. We're going to commit to a war these days. We want to go in with shock and awe, or we don't want to get involved. That's smart thinking. But beyond all that, he's been playing Absalom. You know your dad. You're smart. And you gather the people to yourselves, and you personally go and get your daddy. That's what he's been waiting to hear, verse 14. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. For now, here you go. Here's why. For the Lord had purpose to defeat the good. See, right there, the good advice of Ahithophel. Ahithophel's advice was brilliant. It was perfect. But God's intent, best laid plans, God will undo them to fit his purpose. For the Lord had purpose to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. Pride cometh before the fall. That is why, Christians, it's important that we get our pride in check, that we learn to be humble before God and have a humble, forgiving heart. This one person put it this way: this is the one principle of life which every page of the Bible emphasizes and illustrates. Man cannot escape God, though they go their own way, but the way never sets them free from the authority and invincible power of God. I love that. I love that. I had someone threaten me. I'm like all excited. I had someone threaten me this last week with disaster. There's a disaster. And I was just like, you know what? Go for it. Because here's the thing. If God wants your plan to succeed, he's got something else in store. And he wants me to be humbled. I'm okay with that. But if God doesn't want your plan to succeed, I don't care what you do, it's going to end up in ruin. I suggest that you keep your words to yourself and not try and threaten me like that. It's just foolishness. Because here's the thing, nothing scares me. Threat doesn't scare me. I don't get it. I'm not afraid. I'm really not afraid of anyone's threat. Because I know this. If God's on my side, if God put them there to threaten me and it's going to come to fruition, there's nothing I can do to stop it. I'm just going to see what God wants me to learn in the lesson. Yay. But if God isn't with them, they can make threats. They can even put plans into action. It'll fail because God's on my side. So I love it. And how perfect. Here we have this, and that happened to me this week. And this person really thought they were something. And I was just like, well, I'm just a servant. That's all I am. I've got nothing to fight back with. So, okay, go for it. Have fun. I hope you enjoy yourself. But it's neat. You know, there's an old phrase. It gives you peace when you know that you can just trust in God. But there's an old phrase that says, man plans and God laughs. That's a Yiddish phrase, by the way. And that's so much not our God. Listen, God's not laughing here. Although men have their best laid plans, God's not laughing at them. He's heartbroken. He hates this whole scene. But you know what? He's going to bring judgment on Absalom. That was not God's plan. God's plan would have been that Absalom would have been next in line at this point. Had he just stayed humble and waited for his father to run his course, he would have been next in line. But because of his pride, God's going to crush him and allow him to be crushed. Psalm 33:10 says, the Lord brings the counsel of nations to nothing, and he frustrates the plans of the people. There's nowhere in there that God is laughing. He doesn't think sin is funny. He doesn't think pride is funny, but he will deal with it appropriately. But also, why did God purpose to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel? I'll tell you why. Because David prayed. David prayed. Remember in 2 Samuel 15:31, he said this, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Isn't that what he did? You know why? David is praying and worshiping God. Remember in 15, he's worshiping and praying. He's broken. He's humble. He's in the right place. Prayer moves the hand of God. And David is prayed. He's prayed. He's prayed the right thing. I think in the church, one of the saddest things for my heart is how much prayerlessness there is in the body of Christ. Listen, Matthew 26, if you want to turn there, you can. The Gospel of Matthew 26, starting in verse 36. Matthew 26, 36 says this. Then Jesus came with them to the place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. Okay, so he tells them, sit here, I'm going to go and pray over there. And he took with him Peter, and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. So here he takes the three with him, the inner circle. He takes them further. He leaves the rest here, nine, and he brings three with him, and they see the distress on him. Listen, in a moment, he's going to have the hematidrosis where his capillaries bust under his skin because he's so stressed that blood and sweat mingle out from his pores. That is actually a real thing that happens, medical condition from deep stress. So they see this stress on him. And he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." Now, he told the first group, "We're going to go ahead and I'm going to go over here and pray. You guys stay here." He takes the deeper, the more spiritual guys, the three with him, the ones who were with him on the Mount of Transfiguration. He brings them further and he says, "Listen, I'm stressed, man. I'm going to go over there and pray." And he went a little further and fell on his face. He's not standing. He's not sitting in a chair. He falls on his face. He's so stressed, saying, "Oh, my Father." Now, he's within earshot of the disciples because this is recorded for us. "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." Now, we know what happens to Peter because of prayerlessness. He falls into temptation. And again, a second time, he went and he prayed, saying, "My Father," and then verse 43, and he came and he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away. He didn't even wake them this time. And when he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Jesus is teaching the importance of prayer as a group. I mean, just as a whole. We have a picture of corporate prayer. You guys pray here. The deeper ones, you guys pray here. And then I'm going to go and pray privately. So here we have Jesus saying, corporate prayer is good and private prayer is good. I remember back home at my home church, we would have prayer meetings, and it was always prayer meetings, the lowest attended event at a church. You want to have few people at a church event, have a prayer meeting. So my pastor was getting a little frustrated. And so he says, "Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do an experiment. Let's create an event. And we're going to call it the secret place. But don't tell anybody what it is. It's going to be an hour of prayer." We made posters. We made announcements. The secret place coming, you know, March 20th or whatever. And people would come up to us. "Hey, Pastor Randy, what's the secret place?" "Can't tell you. It's a secret. You got to come." First night, about 50, 60 people. They're like, "Okay, what's the secret place?" He said, "Oh, great. Glad you're here. We're going to pray." Oh, the next night, 30 people. Next night, next week, it was like 10 people. Finally, it was 4 people. There were 4 of us there praying. It wasn't that people didn't have time. When it was a secret place, you know, curiosity got the cat and they came out. They had the time. They just didn't want to make the time. This church, other churches, all churches. I talked to someone else from another church and they were telling me about prayer. He goes, "You know, we have our faithful little group that pray." And I'm like, isn't that sad? Isn't that sad that so few people go to that secret place? And I bet if Jesus were to come here today, he'd probably find a lot of us and say, "Could you not pray for an hour? Look at the world. Look at teens. Look at the news. Look at what's going on. The White House is colored different colors. And what are we doing? We can't even pray. The nation is crumbling. This world is crumbling. But all we want to give is a little bit on Sunday, maybe a little bit during another day. But man, prayer meeting. By the way, we have prayer on Friday nights at 5:30, Saturday mornings at 9, and Sundays at 8:30. Best laid plans. So Hushai warns David to escape. Verse 15, we have intel shared. Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, thus and so Ahithophel advised Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I advise him. Now, therefore, send quickly to tell David, saying, do not spend the night in the plains of the wilderness. By the way, plains of the wilderness, that's the shepherd's field. David was very familiar with that. That's where he spent much of his boyhood, tending to his father's sheep. But speedily cross over, at least the king and all the people who are with him, be swallowed up. Okay, so we come to the informant's quill. So basically he says, listen, get the information to David. I did what I needed to do, and here's what Ahithophel says, and here's my plan. And before they end up realizing that my plan isn't better, you better get news. I bought him some time, but he needs to get out of Dodge quickly. Now we have the informant squealing in verse 17 through 22. I'm going to go a little bit faster here. There's not a lot here, and then I really need to touch on the last part. Now, Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed in En-Rogel, for they dare not be seen coming into the city. So a female servant would come and tell them, and they would go and tell the king. Nevertheless, a lad saw them. So they got spotted by some young man and told Absalom, hey, dude, I saw David's men. They're here. But behold, but both of them went away quickly and came to the man's house in Bahurim, who had a well in his court, and they went down in it. Then a woman took a spread and covered over the well's mouth and spread ground grain on it, and the thing was not known. So she puts this cover over the well hole, and then she just kind of puts dirt and grain and look makes it look like there's nothing there. So they're hiding in a well. Excuse me. And when Absalom's servant came to the woman at the house and said, where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan? So the woman said to them, they are gone over to the water brook. And when they had searched, and I don't think they searched very hard. Listen, you don't want to run into Jonathan at night, okay? You know, two guys going, oh, where's Jonathan? No, I think they just went, hey, is he under that doily over there? No, it's not. Okay, he's not here. Anyways, let's go. They searched and could not find him, and they returned to Jerusalem. Now, it came to pass that after they had departed, that they came up out of the well and went and told King David, and said to David, arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus has Ahithophel advised against you. So they're not even telling David what advice Ahimaaz had given. They just said, Ahithophel has said this. So David's going, okay, I need to get out of here quick because 12,000 men are coming and they're going to try and kill me. So David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan by morning light. Not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. So they all cross over. Now we come to the immense selfishness. And we have enough time to cover this. Thank you, Lord. Now Ahithophel saw that his advice was not taken. In other words, he saw that the guys were all into Ahimaaz's advice, and they had just pushed his advice. They weren't even consulting with him. He saddled his donkey, arose, and went to his house, to his city, put his house in order, hanged himself, and died. And he was buried in his father's tomb. Now, I like what Spurgeon says. Listen to what he says. Spurgeon says, I desire to call your attention to the text on account of its remarkable character. He put his house in order and hanged himself. To put his house in order showed that he was a prudent man. To hang himself proved that he was a fool. Herein is a strange mixture of discretion and desperation. Mind and madness. Shall a man have wisdom enough to arrange his worldly affairs with care, yet shall he be so hapless as to take his own life afterwards? Wow. See, here, I like his statement. Here is an example of the mind and madness all in one. See, to commit suicide is foolishness. The Bible has several people who committed suicide. There's six, actually. Some of them are questionable, like Samson, you know. Some people say that was martyrdom. But had he not been in sin, he probably wouldn't have been there. But there's six. But of them, you have Saul. And we know this. Saul was demon-possessed. We have Judas, who committed suicide. And guess what? Judas was demon-possessed. You know where the first suicide is recorded in the Bible? Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve committed spiritual suicide when they took a bite of the forbidden fruit. But they were influenced by the devil. Listen, when people think about suicide, it's of demonic origin. Suicide is of demonic origin. People come to me and say, Pastor Randy, I feel like I'm losing it. I'm losing it. I'm like, you are losing it. Let it go. That's why you're losing it. You're trying to hold on to a bar of soap. You're squeezing it too hard. Just let it go. Jesus says to he is willing to lose his life will save it, but he who seeks to save his life will lose it. See, suicide is not killing the body. Suicide isn't about killing the body because it's what's inside that's the problem. You can't kill what's inside. People who commit suicide, they'll leave a note and they'll say, I'm ending it all. And what they don't realize is it's not over. Suicide isn't the end, it's the beginning. It's the lie of Satan. Now, let me just say this. If there was nothing, if there was no afterlife, then suicide would be effective. But it's not effective. Why? Because there is an afterlife. And that's what Satan wants you to believe, is there's no afterlife. So just end this life now and get it over with. Listen, suicide is the most selfish thing you can do because it doesn't take into consideration the people you're leaving behind and the hurt. And it's also looking to God and saying, you know what? I will control my life. Suicide is the second leading cause of death between the ages of 10 and 24. How sad is that? And they say that, statistically speaking, 4 out of 5 teens give warning signs before they commit suicide. The Bible tells us that Satan loves to kill, steal, and destroy. But first he pumps up the pride, right? That is why a person commits suicide. I deserve better. I hate my life. I'm not as attractive as that person. I'm not as popular as that person. I don't have this. I don't have that. It's all about what I don't have and why I'm treated this way and that way. Satan loves to kill. You know, people say, well, it's because we don't have. Listen, America's the richest nation in the world, and we have one of the highest suicide rates of all. If stuff made people happy, we should have the lowest amount, but we have one of the highest. Remember what Satan said to Jesus? Hey, throw yourself down off that tower and see if God saves you. See? Suicide. When Jesus put the spirit into the spirits made the pigs jump off, drove them down the embankment and jumped into the river to drown. Then after the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus meets the father who had the son who was demon-possessed. And what did the father say? That the demon often made him throw himself in the fire or tried to drown the young man. That Satan's desire is to kill. Kill your joy, kill your happiness, kill your walk, kill your relationship, kill. But Jesus came to give life and life fuller. Jesus came to give you truth. Satan is a liar and a murderer. Jesus is the truth and life. What a contradiction. What complete opposites. For a Christian to be desiring death. Now listen, Paul said that he and Silas were struggling, even to the point of desiring death, but they didn't commit suicide. They were just stressed out. Listen, brother and sister, we will get stressed out. Maybe there are times that you desire death, but suicide is never the answer. But here's the thing. Pride, bitterness, unforgiveness, those things will kill your life, kill your walk, kill your relationship. If there's anyone here today that has had thoughts recently of suicide or taking your life, man, let me just tell you, Jesus loves you so much. He has something so much better than that. Give him a chance. Seek him. Don't seek death, because that's of the devil. And if you're so prideful that you're harboring bitterness and unforgiveness, man, gals, men and gals, brothers and sisters, get it out. Forgive. Forgive. If you can't forgive, you are severing your relationship with God. I don't care what you think or what you say. You hang on to that bitterness and unforgiveness, you are letting go of Christ. I like what Spurgeon says. I'm going to close with this quote. Thousands set their house in order, but destroy their souls. They look well at their flocks and their herds, but not their hearts' best interests. They gather broken shells with continuous industry, but they throw away precious diamonds. They exercise forethought, prudence, and care everywhere but where they are most required. They save their money, but they squander their happiness. They are guardians of their estates, but suicide for their souls. Let me encourage you. We see some examples here of some men who are full of pride, who are full of bitterness. Ahithophel, so much pride that they didn't listen. He also knows that David's now going to be back on his throne because this plan is going to fail. And so he says, I'm going to end it all. Too much pride, man. So let it go. Let it go. If you need to forgive someone today, forgive them and get right with God. So important. Or you can fool yourself and think you got it under control, and God will show you. Lovingly, humbly, he'll humble you so that you'll cry out to him.